From the primer, Princess Nell's return to the Dark Castle, the death of Harve, the books of the book and of the seed, Princess Nell's quest to find her mother, destruction of the causeway. Nell falls into the hands of fists. She escapes into a greater peril. Deliverance. Princess Nell could have used all of the powers she had acquired during her great quest to dig Harve's grave, or cause the work to be done for her by the disenchanted army. But it did not seem fitting, and so instead she found an old rusty shovel hung up in one of the Dark Castle's outbuildings. The ground was dry and stony, and veined with the roots of thorn bushes, and more than once the shovel struck ancient bones. Princess Nell dug throughout the long day, softening the hard earth with her tears, but did not slacken until the ground was level with her own head. Then she went into the little room in the Dark Castle where Harve had died of a consumption, carefully wrapped his withered body in fine white silk, and bore it out to the grave. She had found lilies growing wild in the overgrown flower garden by the little fisherman's cottage, so she put a spray of these in the grave with him, along with a little children's storybook that Harve had given her for a present many years ago. Harve could not read, and many nights as they had sat round the fire in the courtyard of the Dark Castle, Nell had read to him from this book, and she supposed that he might like to have it wherever he was going now. Filling in the grave went quickly. The loose dirt more than filled the hole. Nell left more lilies atop the long, low mound of earth that marked Harve's resting place. Then she turned her back and walked into the Dark Castle. The stain-colored granite walls had picked up some salmon highlights from the western sky, and she suspected that she could see a beautiful sunset from the room in the high tower where she had established her library. It was a long climb up a dank and mildewy staircase that wound up the inside of the Dark Castle's highest tower. In the circular room at the top, which was built with mullioned windows looking out in all directions, Nell had placed all the books she had gathered during her quest. Books given her as presents by Purple, books from the library of King Magpie, the first fairy king that she had vanquished, and more from the Palace of the Djinn and Castle Turing, and many other hidden libraries and treasuries that she had discovered or pillaged on her way. And, of course, there was the entire library of King Coyote, which contained so many books that she had not even had time to look at them yet. There was so much work to be done. Copies of all of these books had to be made for all of the girls in the disenchanted army. The land beyond had vanished, and Princess Nell wanted to make it anew. She wanted to write down her own story in a great book that young girls could read. And she had one remaining quest that had been pressing on her mind of late, during her long voyage across the empty sea back to the island of the Dark Castle. She wanted to solve the mystery of her own origins. She wanted to find her mother. Even after the destruction of the land beyond, she had sensed the presence of another in the world, one who had always been there. King Coyote himself had confirmed it. Long ago, her stepfather, the kindly fisherman, had received her from mermaids. Whence had the mermaids gotten her? She suspected that the answer could not be found without the wisdom contained in her library. She began by causing a catalogue to be made, starting with the first book she had gotten on her early adventures with her knight friends. At the same time, she established a scriptorium in the great hall of the castle, where thousands of girls sat at long tables making exact copies of all of the books. Most of King Coyote's books had to do with the secrets of atoms and how to put them together to make machines. Naturally, all of them were magic books. The pictures moved, and you could ask them questions and get answers. Some of them were primers and workbooks for novices, and Princess Nell spent a few days studying this art, putting atoms together to make simple machines and then watching them run. Next came a very large set of matched volumes containing reference materials. One contained designs for thousands of sleeve bearings, another for computers made of rods, still another for energy storage devices. And all of them were reactive, so that she could use them to design such things to her own specifications. Then there were more books on the general principles of putting such things together into systems. Finally, King Coyote's library included some books inscribed in the king's own hand, containing designs for his greatest masterpieces. Of these, the two very finest were The Book of the Book and The Book of the Seed. They were magnificent folio-sized volumes, as thick as Princess Nell's hand was broad, bound in rich leather, illuminated with hair-thin gilt lines in an elaborate interlace pattern, and closed with heavy brass hasps and locks. The lock on the Book of the Book yielded to the same key that Princess Nell had taken from King Coyote. She had discovered this very early in her exploration of the library, but was unable to comprehend the contents of this volume until she had studied the others and learnt the secrets of these machines. The Book of the Book contained a complete set of plans for a magical book that would tell stories to a young person, tailoring them for the child's needs and interests, even teaching them how to read if need be. It was a fearsomely complicated work, and Princess Nell only skimmed it at first, recognizing that to understand the particulars might take years of study. The lock on the Book of the Seed would not yield to King Coyote's key, or to any other key in Princess Nell's possession, and because this book had been built atom by atom, it was stronger than any mortal substance and could not possibly be broken open. Princess Nell did not know what this book was about, but the cover bore an inlaid illustration of a striped seed, like the apple-sized seed that she had seen used in King Coyote's city to build a crystal pavilion. And this foreshadowed the book's purpose clearly enough. Nell opened her eyes and propped herself up on one elbow. The primer fell shut and slid off her belly onto the mattress. She had fallen asleep reading it. The girls on their bunk beds lay all around her, breathing quietly and smelling of soap. It made her want to lie back down and sleep, too. But for some reason, she was up on one elbow. Some instinct had told her she had to be up. She sat up and drew her knees up to her chest, freeing the hem of her nightgown from between the sheets, then spun around and dropped to the floor soundlessly. Her bare feet took her silently between the rows of bunks and into the little lounge in the corner of the floor where the girls sat together, had tea, brushed their hair, watched old passives. It was empty now. The lights were off, the corner windows exposing a vast panorama. To the northeast, the lights of New Chuzan and of the Nipponese and Hindustani concessions standing a few kilometers offshore, and the outlying parts of Pudong. Downtown Pudong was all around, its floating mediatronic skyscrapers like biblical pillars of fire. To the northwest lay the Huangpu River, Shanghai, its suburbs, and the ravaged silk and tea districts beyond. No fires burned there now. The feed lines had been burned all the way to the edge of the city, and the fists had stopped at the outskirts and hunkered down as they sought a way to penetrate the tattered remains of the security grid. Nell's eye was drawn toward the water. Downtown Pudong offered the most spectacular urban nightscape ever devised, but she always found herself looking past it, staring instead at the Huangpu or the Yangtze to the north, or to the curvature of the Pacific beyond New Chuzan. She'd been having a dream, she realized. She had awakened not because of any external disturbance, but because of what had happened in that dream. She had to remember it. Of course, she couldn't. Just a few snatches. A woman's face, a beautiful young woman, perhaps wearing a crown, but seen muddily, as through turbulent water. And something that glittered in her hands. No, dangling beneath her hands. A piece of jewelry on a golden chain. Could it have been a key? Nell could not bring the image back, but an instinct told her that it was. Another detail, too. A gleaming swath of something that passed in front of her face once, twice, three times. Something yellow with a repeating pattern woven into it. A crest consisting of a book, a seed, and crossed keys. Cloth of gold. Long ago, the mermaids had brought her to her stepfather, and she had been wrapped in cloth of gold, and from this she had always known that she was a princess. The woman in the dream, veiled in swirling water, must have been her mother. The dream was a memory from her lost infancy, and before her mother had given her up to the mermaids, she had given Princess Nell a golden key on a chain. Nell perched herself on the windowsill, leaned against the pane, opened the primer, and flipped all the way back to the beginning. It started with the same old story as ever, but told now in more mature prose. She read the story of how her stepfather had gotten her from the mermaids, and read it again, drawing out more details, asking it questions, calling up detailed illustrations. There, in one of the illustrations, she saw it. Her stepfather's lockbox, a humble plank chest bound in rusted iron straps, with a heavy, old-fashioned padlock stored beneath his bed. It was in this chest that he had stored the cloth of gold, and, perhaps, the key as well. Paging forward through the book, she came across a long-forgotten story of how, following her stepfather's disappearance, her wicked stepmother had taken the lockbox to a high cliff above the sea and flung it into the waves, destroying any evidence that Princess Nell was of royal blood. She had not known that her stepdaughter was watching her from between the branches of a thicket, where she often concealed herself during her stepmother's rages. Nell flipped to the last page of the young lady's illustrated primer. As Princess Nell approached the edge of the cliff, picking her way along carefully through the darkness, taking care not to snag the train of her nightgown on thorny shrubs, she experienced a peculiar feeling that the entire ocean had become dimly luminescent. She had often noticed this phenomenon from the high windows of her library in the tower, and reckoned that the waves must be reflecting back the light of the moon and stars. But this was a cloudy night. The sky was like a bowl of carved onyx, allowing no light to pass down from the heavens. The light she saw must emanate from beneath. Arriving cautiously at the rim of the cliff, she saw that her surmise was true. The ocean, the one constant in all the world, the place from where she had come as an infant, from which the land beyond had grown out of King Coyote's seed and into which it had dissolved, the ocean was alive. Since the departure of King Coyote, Princess Nell had supposed herself entirely alone in the world. But now she saw cities of light beneath the waves and knew that she was alone only by her own choice. Princess Nell gathered the hem of her nightgown in both hands and raised it over her head, letting the chill wind stream over her body and carry the garment away, Nell said. Then, drawing a deep breath and closing her eyes, she bent her legs and sprang forward into space. She was reading about the way the illuminated waves rushed up toward her, when suddenly the room filled with light. She looked toward the door, thinking that someone had come in and turned the lights on, but she was alone in the room, and the light was flickering against the wall. She turned her head the other way. The center span of the causeway had become a ball of white light, hurling its marbled shroud of cold dark matter into the night. The sphere expanded until it seemed to occupy most of the interval between New Chuzan and the Pudong shoreline, though by this time the color had deepened from white into reddish-orange, and the explosion had punched a sizable crater into the water, which developed into a circular wave of steam and spray that ran effortlessly across the ocean's surface like the arc of light cast by a pocket torch. Fragments of the giant feed line that had once constituted most of the causeway's mass had been pitched into the sky by the explosion and now tumbled end over end through the night sky, the slowness of their movements bespeaking their size, casting yellow sulphurous light over the city as they burned furiously in the wind blast created by their own movement. The light limned a pair of tremendous pillars of water vapor rising from the ocean north and south of the causeway. Nell realized that the fists must have blown the Nipponese and Hindustani feeds at the same moment. So the Fists of Righteous Harmony had nanotechnological explosives now. They'd come a long way since they'd tried to torch the bridge over the Huang Pu with a few cylinders of hydrogen. The shock wave rapped at the window, startling several of the girls from sleep. Nell heard them murmuring to one another in the bunk room. She wondered if she should go in and warn them that Pudong was cut off now, that the final assault of the fists had commenced. But though she could not understand what they were saying, she could understand their tone of voice clearly enough. They were not surprised by this, nor unhappy. They were all Chinese and could become subjects of the Celestial Kingdom simply by donning the conservative garb of that tribe and showing due deference to any Mandarins who happened by. No doubt, this was exactly what they would do as soon as the fists came to Pudong. Some of them might suffer deprivation, imprisonment, or rape, but within a year they would all be integrated into the CK as if the Coastal Republic had never existed. But if the news feeds from the interior meant anything, the fists would kill Nell gradually, with many small cuts and burns when they grew weary of raping her. In recent days, she had often seen the Chinese girls talking in little groups and sneaking glances at her, and the suspicion had grown in her breast that some of them might know the attack in advance and might make arrangements to turn Nell over to the fists as a demonstration of their loyalty. She opened the door a crack and saw two of these girls padding toward the bunk room where Nell usually slept, carrying lengths of red polymer ribbon. As soon as they had stolen into Nell's bunk room, Nell ran down the corridor and got to the elevators. As she awaited the elevator, she was more scared than she had ever been. The sight of the cruel red ribbons in the small hands of the girls had, for some reason, struck more terror into her heart than the sight of knives in the hands of fists. A shrill commotion arose from the bunk room. The bell for the elevator sounded. She heard the bunk room door fly open and someone running down the hall. The elevator door opened. One of the girls came into the lobby, saw her, and shrieked something to the others in a dolphin-like squeal. Nell got into the elevator, punched the button for the lobby, and held down the door close button. The girl thought for a moment, then stepped forward to hold the door. Several more girls were running down the hall. Nell kicked the girl in the face, and she spun away in a helix of blood. The elevator door began to close. Just as the two doors were meeting in the center, through the narrowing slit, she saw one of the other girls diving toward the wall button. The doors closed. There was a brief pause, and then they slid open again. Nell was already in the correct stance to defend herself. If she had to beat each of the girls to death individually, she would do it. But none of them rushed the elevator. Instead, the leader stepped forward and aimed something at Nell. There was a little popping noise, a pinprick in Nell's midsection, and within a few seconds, she felt her arms becoming impossibly heavy. Her bottom drooped, her head bowed, her knees buckled. She could not keep her eyes open. As they closed, she saw the girls coming toward her, smiling with pleasure, holding up the red ribbons. Nell could not move any part of her body, but she remained perfectly conscious as they tied her up with the ribbon. They did it slowly and methodically and perfectly. They did it every day of their lives. The tortures of the next few hours were of a purely experimental and preliminary nature. They did not last for long and accomplished no permanent damage. These girls had made a living out of binding and torturing people in a way that didn't leave scars, and that was all they really knew. When the leader came up with the idea of shoving a cigarette into Nell's cheek, it was something entirely novel and left the rest of the girls startled and silent for a few minutes. Nell sensed that most of the girls had no stomach for such things and merely wanted to turn her over to the fists in exchange for citizenship in the Celestial Kingdom. The fists themselves began to arrive some 12 hours later. Some of them wore conservative business suits, some wore the uniforms of the building security force, others looked as if they'd arrived to take a girl out to a disco. They all had things to do when they arrived. It was obvious that this suite would act as a local headquarters of some sort when the rebellion began in earnest. They began to bring up supplies on the freight elevator and seemed to spend a lot of time on the telephone. More arrived every hour until Madame Ping's suite was playing host to between 1 and 2 dozen. Some of them were very tired and dirty and went to sleep in the bunks immediately. In a way, Nell wished that they would do whatever they were going to do and get it over with fast. But nothing happened for quite some time. When the first fists arrived, the girls brought them in to see Nell, who had been shoved under a bed and was now lying there in a puddle of her own urine. The leader shone a light on her face briefly and then turned away, completely uninterested. It seemed that once he verified that the girls had done their bit for the revolution, Nell ceased to be relevant. She supposed it was inevitable that, in due time, these men would take those liberties with her that have ever been claimed as angry by irregular fighting men, who have willfully severed themselves from the softening feminine influence of civilized society with those women who have had the misfortune to become their captives. To make this prospect less attractive, she took the desperate measure of allowing her person to become tainted with the noisome issue of her natural internal processes. But most of the fists were too busy, and when some of the grungy foot soldier types arrived, Madame Ping's girls were eager to make themselves useful in this regard. Nell reflected that a bunch of soldiers who found themselves billeted in a bawdy house would naturally arrive with certain expectations, and that the inmates would be unwise to disappoint them. Nell had gone into the world to seek her fortune, and this was what she had found. She understood more forcibly than ever the wisdom of Miss Matheson's remarks about the hostility of the world and the importance of belonging to a powerful tribe. All of Nell's intellect, her vast knowledge and skills, accumulated over a lifetime of intensive training, meant nothing at all when she was confronted with a handful of organized peasants. She could not really sleep in her current position, but drifted in and out of consciousness, visited occasionally by hallucinatory waking dreams. More than once, she dreamed that the constable had come in his hoplite suit to rescue her, and the pain she felt when she returned to full consciousness and realized that her mind had been lying to her was worse than any tortures others might inflict. Eventually, they got tired of the stink under the bed and dragged her out of there on a smear of half-dried body fluids. It had been at least 36 hours since her capture. The leader of the girls, the one who had put out the cigarette on Nell's face, cut the red ribbon away and cut off Nell's filthy nightgown with it. Nell's limbs bounced on the floor. The leader had brought a whip that they sometimes used on clients and beat Nell with it until circulation returned. This spectacle drew quite a crowd of fist soldiers who crowded into the bunk room to watch. The girl drove Nell on hands and knees to a maintenance closet and made her get out a bucket and mop. Then she made Nell clean up the mess under the bed, frequently inspecting the results and beating her, apparently acting out a parody of a rich Westerner bossing around some poor running dog. It became clear after the third or fourth scrubbing of the floor that this was being done as much for the entertainment of the soldiers as for hygienic reasons. Then it was back to the maintenance closet, where Nell was bound again, this time with lightweight police shackles, and left there on the floor in the dark, naked and filthy. A few minutes later, her possessions, some clothes that the girls didn't like and a book they couldn't read, were thrown in there with her. When she was sure that the girl with the whip had gone, she spoke to her primer and told it to make light. She could see a big matter compiler on the floor in the back of the closet. The girls used it to manufacture larger items when they were needed. This building was apparently hooked up to the Coastal Republic's Pudong feed because it hadn't lost feed services when the causeway had blown up. And indeed, the fists probably would not have bothered to establish their base here if the place had been cut off. Once every couple of hours or so, a fist would come into this closet and order the MC to create something, usually a simple bulk substance like rations. On two of these occasions, Nell was outraged in the manner she had long suspected was inevitable. She closed her eyes during the commission of these atrocities, knowing that whatever might be done to the mere vessel of her soul by the likes of these, her soul itself was as serene, as remote from their grasp, as is the full moon from the furious incantations of an aboriginal shaman. She tried to think about the machine that she was designing in her head, with the help of the primer, about how the gears meshed and the bearings spun, how the rod logic was programmed, and where the energy was stored. On her second night in the closet, after most of the fists had gone to bed and use of the matter compiler had apparently ceased for the night, she instructed the primer to load her design into the MC's memory, then crept forward and pressed the start button with her tongue. 10 minutes later, the machine released its vacuum with a shriek. Nell tongued the door open. A knife and a sword rested on the floor of the MC. She turned herself around, moving in small, cautious increments and breathing deeply so that she would not whimper from the pain emanating from those parts of her that were most tender and vulnerable and yet had been most viciously depredated by her captors. She reached backward with her shackled hands and gripped the handle of the knife. Footsteps were approaching down the hallway. Someone must have heard the hiss of the MC and thought it was dinner time. But Nell couldn't rush this. She had to be careful. The door opened. It was one of the ranking fists, perhaps the rough equivalent of a sergeant. He shone a torch in her face, then chuckled and turned on the overhead light. Nell's body blocked his view of the MC, but it was obvious that she was reaching for something. He probably assumed it was only food. He stepped forward and kicked her casually in the ribs, then grabbed her upper arm and jerked her away from the MC, causing such pain in her wrists that tears spurted down her face. But she held on to the knife. The fist was staring into the MC. He was startled, and would be for several moments. Nell maneuvered the knife so that the blade was touching nothing but the link between the shackles, then hit the on switch. It worked. The edge of the blade came to life like a nanotech chainsaw and zipped through the link in a moment, like clipping a fingernail. Nell brought it around her body in the same motion and buried it in the base of the fist's spine. He fell to the ground without speaking. He wasn't feeling any pain from that wound or from anything below his waist. Before he could assess matters any further, she plunged the knife into the base of his skull. He was wearing simple peasant stuff, indigo trousers and a tank top. She put them on. Then she tied her hair up behind her head using strings cut from a mop and devoted a precious minute or two stretching her arms and legs. And then it was out into the hallway with her knife in her waistband and her sword in her hands. Going round a corner, she cut a man in half as he emerged from the bathroom. The sword kept going of its own momentum and carved a long gash in the wall. This assault released a prodigious amount of blood, which Nell put behind her as quickly as possible. Another man was on guard in the elevator lobby, and as he came to investigate the sounds, she ran him through several times quickly, taking a page from Napier's book this time. The elevators were now under some kind of central control and probably subject to surveillance. Rather than press the button in the lobby, she cut a hole in the doors, sheathed her sword, and clambered out onto a ladder that ran down the shaft. She forced herself to descend slowly and carefully, pressing herself flat against the rungs whenever the car went by. By the time she had descended perhaps 50 or 60 floors, the building had come awake. All of the cars were in constant motion, and when they went past her, she could hear men talking excitedly inside them. Light flooded into the shaft several floors below. The doors had been forced open. A couple of fists thrust their heads out carefully into the shaft and began looking up and down, shining torches here and there. Several floors below them, more fists pried another door open, but they had to pull their heads in rapidly as the ascending car nearly decapitated them. She had imagined that Madame Pings was playing host to an isolated cell of fists, but it was now clear that most, if not all, of the building had been taken over. For that matter, all of Pudong might now be a part of the Celestial Kingdom. Nell was much more profoundly isolated than she had feared. The skin of her arms glowed yellow-pink in the beam of a torch shone up from below. She did not make the mistake of looking down into the dazzling light, and did not have to. The excited voice of the fist below told her that she had been discovered. A moment later, the light vanished as the ascending elevator interposed itself between Nell and the fists who had seen her. She recalled Harv and his buds elevator surfing in their old building and reckoned that this would be a good time to take up the practice. As the car rose toward her, she jumped off the ladder, trying to give herself enough upward thrust to match its velocity. She landed hard on the roof, for it was moving far more rapidly than she could jump. The roof knocked her feet out from under her, and she fell backward, slamming her arms out as Dojo had taught her, so that she absorbed the impact with her fists and forearms, not her back. More excited talking from inside the car. The access panel on the roof suddenly flew into the air, driven out of its frame by a well-delivered kick from below. A head popped out of the open hatch. Nell skewered it on her knife. The man tumbled down into the car. There was no point in waiting now. The situation had gone into violent motion, which Nell was obliged to use. She rolled onto her belly and kicked both feet downward into the hatch, spun down into the car, landed badly on the corpse, and staggered to one knee. She had barked the point of her chin on the edge of the hatch as she fell through and bitten her tongue, so she was slightly dazed. A gaunt man in a black leather skullcap was standing directly in front of her, reaching for a gun, and while she was shoving her knife up through the center of his thorax, she bumped into someone behind her. She jumped to her feet and spun around, terrified, readying the knife for another blow, and discovered a much more terrified man in a blue coverall, standing by the elevator's control panel, holding his arms up in front of his face and screaming. Nell stepped back and lowered the point of the knife. The man was wearing the uniform of a building services worker and had obviously been yanked away from whatever he had been doing and put in charge of the elevator's controls. The man whom Nell had just killed, the one in the black leather skullcap, was some sort of low-level official in the rebellion and could not be expected to demean himself by punching the buttons himself. "Keep going! Up! Up!" she said, pointing at the ceiling. The last thing she wanted was for him to stop the elevator at Madame Ping's. The man bowed several times in quick succession and did something with the controls, then turned and smiled ingratiatingly at Nell. As a Coastal Republic citizen working in services, he knew a few words of English, and Nell knew a few of Chinese. "Down below, fists?" she said.
"Many fists."
"Ground floor, fists?"
"Yes, many fists ground floor."
"Street, fists?"
"Fist army have fight in street."
"Around this building?"
"Fist around this building all over."
Nell looked at the elevator's control panel. Four columns of tightly spaced buttons, color-coded according to each floor's function. Green for shopping, yellow for residential, red for offices, and blue for utility floors. Most of the blue floors were below ground level, but one of them was fifth from the top.
"Building office?" she said, pointing to it.
"Yes."
"Fists there?"
"No, fists all down below, but fist on roof."
"Go there."
When the elevator reached the fifth floor from the top, Nell had the man freeze it there, then climbed on top and trashed its motors so that it would remain there. She dropped back into the car, trying not to look at the bodies or smell the reek of blood and other body fluids that had gotten all over it and that were now draining out the open doors and dripping down the shaft. It would not take long for any of this to be discovered. She had some time, though. All she had to do was decide how to make use of it. The maintenance closet had a matter compiler, just like the one Nell had used to make her weapons, and she knew that she could use it to compile explosives and booby-trap the lobby. But the fists had explosives of their own, and could just as well blow the top floors of the building to kingdom come. For that matter, they were probably down in some basement control room, watching traffic on the building's feed network. Use of the MC would simply announce her location. They would shut off the feed, and then come after her, slowly and carefully. She took a quick tour of the offices, sizing up her resources. Looking out the panoramic windows of the finest office suite, she saw a new state of affairs in the streets of Pudong. Many of the skyscrapers had been rooted in lines from the foreign feeds and were now dark, though in some places flames vented from broken windows, casting primitive illumination over the streets 1,000 feet below. These buildings had mostly been evacuated, and so the streets were crowded with far more people than they could really handle. The plaza immediately surrounding this particular building had been staked out by a picket line of fists and was relatively uncrowded. She found a windowless room with mediatronic walls that bore a bewildering collage of images. Flowers, details of European cathedrals and Shinto temples, Chinese landscape art, magnified images of insects and pollen grains, many armed Indian goddesses, planets and moons of the solar system, abstract patterns from the Islamic world, graphs of mathematical equations, headshots of models, male and female. Other than that, the room was empty, except for a model of the building that stood in the center of the room, about Nell's height. The model's skin was mediatronic, just like the skin of the building itself, and it was currently echoing, as she supposed, whatever images were being displayed on the outside of the building. Mostly advertising panels, though some fists had apparently come in here and scrawled graffiti across them. On the top of the model rested a stylus, just a black stick pointed on one end, and a palette, covered with a color wheel and other controls. Nell picked them up, touched the tip of the stylus to a green area on the palette's color wheel, and drew it across the surface of the model. A glowing green line appeared along the track of the stylus, disfiguring an ad panel for an airship line. Whatever other steps Nell might take in the time she had left, there was one thing she could do quickly and easily here. She was not entirely sure why she did it, but some intuition told her that it might be useful. Or perhaps it was an artistic urge to make something that would live longer than she would, even if only by a few minutes. She began by erasing all of the big advertising panels on the upper levels of the skyscraper. Then she sketched out a simple line drawing in primary colors, an escutcheon in blue, and within it a crest depicting a book drawn in red and white, crossed keys in gold, and a seed in brown. She caused this image to be displayed on all sides of the skyscraper, between the 100th and 200th floors. Then she tried to think of a way out of this place. Perhaps there were airships on the roof. There would certainly be fist guards up there, but perhaps through a combination of stealth and suddenness, she could overcome them. She used the emergency stairs to make her way up to the next floor, then the next, and then the next. Two flights above, she could hear fist guards posted at the roof, talking to each other and playing mahjong. Many flights below, she could hear more fists making their way up the stairs one flight at a time, looking for her. She was pondering her next move when the guards above her were rudely interrupted by orders squawking from their radios. Several fists came charging down the stairway, shouting excitedly. Nell, trapped in the stairwell, made herself ready to ambush them as they came toward her. But instead, they ran into the top floor and made for the elevator lobby. Within a minute or two, an elevator had arrived and carried them away. Nell waited for a while, listening, and could no longer hear the contingent approaching from below. She climbed up the last flights of stairs and emerged onto the building's roof, exhilarated as much by the fresh air as by the discovery that it was completely deserted. She walked to the edge of the roof and peered down almost half a mile to the street. In the black windows of a dead skyscraper across the way, she could see the mirror image of Princess Nell's crest. After a minute or two, she noticed that something akin to a shockwave was making its way down the street far below, moving in slow motion, covering a city block every couple of minutes. Details were difficult to make out at this distance. It was a highly organized group of pedestrians, all wearing the same generally dark clothing, ramming its way through the mob of refugees, forcing the panicked barbarians toward the picket line of the fists or sideways into the lobbies of the dead buildings. Nell was transfixed for several minutes by this sight. Then she happened to glance down a different street and saw the same phenomenon there. She made a quick circuit of the building's roof. All in all, several columns were advancing inexorably on the foundations of the building where Nell stood. In time, one of these columns broke through the last of the obstructing refugees and reached the edge of the broad open plaza that surrounded the foot of Nell's building, where it faced off against the fist defenses. The column stopped abruptly at this point and waited for a few minutes, collecting itself and waiting for the other columns to catch up. Nell had supposed at first that these columns might be fist reinforcements converging on this building, which was clearly intended to be the headquarters of their final assault on the coastal republic. But it soon became evident that these newcomers had arrived for other purposes. After a few minutes of unbearable tension had gone by in nearly perfect silence, the columns suddenly, on the same unheard signal, erupted into the plaza. As they debouched from the narrow streets, they spread out into many-pronged formations, arranging themselves with the precision of a professional drill team, and then charged forward into the suddenly panicked and disorganized fists, throwing up a tremendous battle cry.
When that sound echoed up 200 stories to Nell's ears, she felt her hair standing on end, because it was not the deep, lusty roar of grown men, but the fierce thrill of thousands of young girls, sharp and penetrating as the skirl of massed bagpipes. It was Nell's tribe, and they had come for their leader. Nell spun on her heel and made for the stairway. By the time she had reached ground level and burst out, somewhat unwisely, into the building's lobby, the girls had breached the walls of the building in several places and rushed in upon the remaining defenders. They moved in groups of four. One girl, the largest, would rush toward an opponent holding a pointed bamboo stick aimed at his heart. While his attention was thus fixed, two other girls, the smallest, would converge on him from the sides. Each girl would hug one of his legs, and, acting together, they would lift him off the ground. The fourth girl, the fastest, would by this point have circled all the way round and would come in from behind, driving a knife or other weapon into the victim's back. During the half-dozen or so applications of this technique that Nell had witnessed, it never failed, and none of the girls ever suffered more than the odd bruise or scrape. Suddenly, she felt a moment of wild panic as she thought that they were doing the same to her. But after she had been lifted into the air, no attack came from front or back, though many girls rushed in from all sides, each adding her small strength to the paramount goal of hoisting Nell high into the air. Even as the last remnants of the fists were being hunted down and destroyed in the nooks and corners of the lobby, Nell was being borne on the shoulders of her little sisters, out the front doors of the building and into the plaza, where something like 100,000 girls, Nell could not count all the regiments and brigades, collapsed to their hands and knees in unison as though struck down by a divine wind, and presented her their bamboo stakes, pole knives, lead pipes, and nunchucks. The provisional commanders of her divisions stood foremost, as did her provisional ministers of defense, of state, and of research and development, all of them bowing to Nell, not with a Chinese bow or a Victorian one, but something they'd come up with that was in between. Nell should have been tongue-tied and paralyzed with astonishment, but she was not. For the first time in her life, she understood why she'd been put on the earth and felt comfortable with her position. One moment, her life had been a meaningless abortion, and the next, it all made glorious sense. She began to speak, the words rushing from her mouth as easily as if she'd been reading them from the pages of the primer. She accepted the allegiance of the Mouse Army, complimented them on their great deeds, and swept her arm across the plaza, over the heads of her little sisters, toward the thousands upon thousands of stranded sojourners from New Atlantis, Nippon, Israel, and all of the other outer tribes. "Our first duty is to protect these," she said. "Show me the condition of the city and all those in it." They wanted to carry her, but she jumped to the stones of the plaza and strode away from the building toward her ranks, which parted to make way for her. The streets of Pudong were filled with hungry and terrified refugees. And through them, in simple peasant clothes streaked with the blood of herself and of others, broken shackles dangling from her wrists, followed by her generals and ministers, walked the barbarian princess with her book and her sword. Carl Hollywood takes a stroll to the waterfront. Carl Hollywood was awakened by a ringing in his ears and a burning in his cheek that turned out to be an inch-long fragment of plate glass driven into his flesh. When he sat up, his bed made clanking and crashing noises, shedding a heavy burden of shattered glass, and a fetid exhalation from the wrecked windows blew over his face. Old hotels had their charms, but disadvantages too, such as window panes made out of antique materials. Fortunately, some old Wyoming instinct had caused him to leave his boots next to the bed the night before. He inverted each one and carefully probed it for broken glass before he pulled it on. Only when he had put on all of his clothes and gathered his things together did he go to look out the window. His hotel was near the Huang Pu waterfront. Looking across the river, he could see that great patches of Pudong had gone black against the indigo sky of pre-dawn.
A few buildings connected to the indigenous feeds were still lit up. On this side of the river, the situation was not so simple. Shanghai, unlike Pudong, had lived through many wars and was therefore made to be robust. The city was rife with secret power sources, old diesel generators, private sources and feeds, water tanks and cisterns. People still raised chickens for food in the shadow of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. Shanghai would weather the onslaught of the fists much better than Pudong. But as a white person, Carl Hollywood might not weather it very well at all. It was better to be across the river in Pudong with the rest of the outer tribes. From here to the waterfront was about 3 blocks, but since this was Shanghai, those 3 blocks were fraught with what in any other city would be 3 miles worth of complications. The main problem was going to be fists. He could already hear the cries of "Sha! Sha!" boiling up from the streets, and shining a pocket torch through the bars of his balcony, he could see many fists, emboldened by the destruction of the foreign feeds, running around with their scarlet girdles and headbands exposed to the world. If he weren't 6.5 feet tall and blue-eyed, he'd probably try to disguise himself as Chinese and slink to the waterfront, and it probably wouldn't work. He went through his closet and hauled out his big duster, which swept nearly to his ankles. It was proof against bullets and most nanotech projectiles. There was a long item of luggage he had thrown up on the closet shelf unopened. Hearing the reports of trouble, he had taken the precaution of bringing these relics with him. An engraved lever-action 44 caliber rifle with low-tech iron sights and, as a last-ditch sort of thing, a Colt revolver. These were unnecessarily glorious weapons, but he had long ago gotten rid of any of his guns that did not have historical or artistic value.